Calcio Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the Friday episode of the Calcio Land Podcast. So we have a really good one today. We're going to try something different at the end. We have a great first-time guest, my friend Benny Giardina from Sicily. We've never had a guest dial in from Sicily, and we had an awesome tribute to former Palermo president Zamparini. I went out of my way to do a chat on Zamparini where we barely, if at all, talked about all the managers that he sacked. So I think you'll enjoy that at the end. We wanted to cover Milan. We have our great friend from Vox to Box, Daniele Mazzanti. He's a regular on the show. So we talked on what has been really a great week if you're a Milan fan. That's a fun interview. And of course, since it's Friday and we have Serie A, there are some huge games this weekend. We have 1,000 names on deck with his predictions. But before we get to all that, I'm joined by our dear friend, the producer, co-host of this show, Alex Goldberg, who, of course, does a fantastic job covering Chelsea on his own Byline podcast. So, Alex, speaking of Chelsea, there is a connection to Serie A, so I want to ask you this. So we had yesterday, Boga had a great goal for Atalanta, the Coppa Italia. He was their big January signing. And now with the injury to Zapata, which really is a big deal for Atalanta, they are linked pretty heavily with Diego Costa. Now, maybe it's more on Diego Costa's side that they're trying to get him over to Atalanta. But it's not out of the question, Alex, that very soon we could have, two figures from Chelsea, who I think are pretty interesting because of how different their backgrounds are. So let me ask you this. Say we had done this podcast 2 years ago, and I'd be like, Alex, in 2 years, we could have Boga and Diego Costa at Atalanta. And 2 years ago is right when Atalanta's profile was raising. Which of the two would have surprised you more?
Well, first of all, I would have said I'm going to become an Atalanta fan because I really have always liked Jeremy Boga. You know that. And I love Diego Costa. I really, really do. And maybe I'm also saying that extra because Lukaku has been like the opposite of Costa, you know, wants to be perceived as Costa, but just isn't Costa. He wants to be perceived, I keep saying it, but as an alpha. Diego Costa is a effing alpha. But anyway, to actually get to your question, who would have surprised me more? Well, I gotta say, and David, I don't really know my thought process behind this, but Diego Costa and Atalanta is so random to me. Like, that is so random to me from where I sit, because the way I view him is, of course, as a Chelsea player first and foremost, but then as Spanish or Brazilian, just in terms of where he's played and obviously his background. So Atletico Madrid is obviously a place I always envision him, or even maybe a lower level Spanish club later on in his life, or China, because of course that created the drama when he was at Chelsea, trying to bounce somewhere random, but then obviously playing maybe at a Brazilian club like he has. But Atalanta, a Serie A club, and I'm not demeaning Atalanta, you know I love them. So if there's an Atalanta fan listening, this is not me at all poo-pooing your club. I just think that's so freaking random. Whereas 2 years ago, like you phrased the question, Boga was in Serie A. So I think I have to say that the Costa thing would surprise me a bit more. But to tell me straight up that they could be teammates, I mean, that would really, really surprise me, just because, of course, they've been at Chelsea but had wildly different paths. And when Diego Costa was thriving at Chelsea, Jeremy Boga was just one of those classic young Chelsea players that probably should have been getting more minutes but couldn't. And I'll never forgive Gary Cahill for getting a red card about 20 minutes in on Boga's first start of the season under Antonio Conte, first Premier League game of the season. Conte took Boga off and he never played for Chelsea again. Thanks, Gary Cahill. And thanks, Antonio Conte. I'm glad you lost this week, by the way. Oh, David, I hate to divert again. I know I'm supposed to keep to this top segment, and I will, but Conte's tears this week were beautiful. But anyway, I digress. very random, in my opinion. I really would love for this to happen because I think Diego Costa still has something in him. There's a lot of Chelsea fans over this Lukaku drama that were saying, Costa on a free? Let's get him in. But don't you just kind of feel that Costa also will do well there? Like, he's not going to start every game or be a monumental player for them, but I feel like he'd have a pretty good goals per 90 minutes ratio. So, yeah, if I had to pick who would surprise me more between Boga and Costa, I would say Costa because it's just so random to me. But to just group them together and say they'd be teammates at Atalanta, if you told me that a couple years ago, I'd be like, no, that's just not going to happen. That's way too wild and random. But I just have to once again stress, Atalanta fans, this is not because I view you guys less than or not good enough for those players. Far from it. Far from it. It's just I still don't necessarily view you as a destination for random players. And in this case, I'm seeing Diego Costa's kind of random. So, yeah, David, that's how I view it. And just overall, while we're on the subject here of Atalanta, what do you make of their recent struggles? I know they dropped yesterday to Fiorentina. Are they in serious jeopardy of dropping out of the top four, obviously, then circling back to Serie A, but just overall their form lately? Thoughts?
Yeah, a lot. And quickly on what you said, a great answer as usual. Yeah, Diego Costa to Atalanta is a little bit like when Boateng went to Barcelona to me. It does feel like totally random. Like I had to check that. Again, you know, there's been buzz because Diego Costa was also linked to Salernitana or in last place in Serie A. That's because they have Sabatini, who's a great sporting director. And so instead of being smack in the relegation race, if he goes to Atalanta, he's in a Champions League race. And I would really like to see it. I'm with you. I think Diego Costa as a character would be superb in Serie A. It's interesting that you mentioned Antonio Conte, and they certainly had an interesting relationship. I could see him, if it does happen, him and Gasperini probably not having a great relationship. Gasperini is a little bit similar to Conte, but in a little bit of a different way. I think Conte at least has a big club mentality, and for the most part, I think does pretty well with stars, while Gasperini maybe not so much. But look, to tie it back to Atalanta's form, you know, we often talk about Atalanta being one of the smartest clubs in Serie A. I think we, at least I do, I kind of view them and Napoli as the teams that, you know, if I was running a team, I would try to do it the way they do. But I've this January window, I think in some ways, and this is a little bit of Monday morning quarterbacking, but now they really found themselves pretty short at a striker. They loaned out Piccoli, who was a bench player for them, but I think he scored in the first game of the season off the bench, and he's a very highly rated prospect and pretty similar build to Zapata. Like, he's a really nice alternative to Muriel. It's great if you have both. And they, at the end of the January window, loaned him out to Genoa, which in the moment you're like, okay, he's going to a team where he's going to play a lot, great. But Duvan Zapata was battling injuries, and he had injuries in recent years. This didn't come out totally out of the blue. And interestingly, I think there was a game, Diego Costa, I think, I don't know if it was a Champions League final, where he was coming back from an injury too soon, and then he got hurt again. And ironically, it's exactly what happened to Zapata. So he's the biggest name striker that they could sign. I mean, another player that they could get is Graziano Pelé, whose contract with Parma expired last season. Obviously nowhere near the profile as Diego Costa. They could just keep with what they have, so have Muriel as their only real natural striker and then try some different things with the others. I mean, they do have a lot of wingers attacking players that can support him, but Muriel is their only classic striker. So I think they're going to try to bring in a number nine. But they are in trouble. Like, the elimination in the Coppa Italia, I thought they played well. Although Fiorentina were down to 10 men, there were some controversial decisions. Gasperini didn't even show up to the post-match press conference. And to me, that's a little bit concerning because I think this season could go south. They had a really bad loss in Serie A last week at home against Cagliari. And I think Cagliari's won in Bergamo 4 out of the last 5 times, which is really crazy. But it really goes to show those are exactly the games games that have held back Atalanta from being, you know, a consistent top four contender to really getting to the next step and being a legit title contender. And look, you know, we've been talking a lot about last week. We did a big show on Juve turning the page, and they look like a completely different club, like Vlahovic. I said it on the Tuesday pod that we do for patrons. He really reminds me as a cross as when Ibrahimovic first came to Juve, when Maggi brought him from Ajax, and Tevez, especially when Tevez arrived at Juve. And I mean that more in the way the team, he's just lifted that team and just plays with swagger and charisma that really reminds me of Tevez. So Juve look like a really, really strong contender to finish in the top four. Hey, there's even people that are starting to say, hey, can Juve even contend for the title this late? I don't think they can, but they look really primed for a top four spot. And on the pod, and as usual, every time I try to talk my way out of Milan being either a Scudetto contender or being a team that could drop out of the top four. Like, look at how Milan changed everything with the derby this week, too. They also have the boost of the Theo Hernandez extension, which will probably be announced by the time you hear this pod. And you'll hear Daniele Mazzanti. It's just a great period to be a Milan fan. So you could point to Atalanta being the one team that Juve can take out of the top four, especially with this Zapata injury, because so much of Atalanta's attack really is that, you know, Zapata kind of body punches you for a while, and then you bring in Muriel off the bench, and he's going to do with the speed, the haymaker, just take you out. So they're missing out that formula. Now, granted, Atalanta are deeper than they've been in previous season. They have a keeper that's as good, you know, on the maybe not a playing to the level of Maignan has recently, but, you know, you look at the teams that are that Atalanta's competing with for a Champions League spot. Now they have a keeper that is definitely in line with the others. We know Atalanta are a second half team, but I really could see like the 1-2 punch of being taken out of the Coppa Italia, which, you know, they haven't won a trophy in 60 years, is probably the one they had the best shot at. So look, I love Gasperini, but he is a little bit of a front runner. There's no doubt about it. And things maybe aren't as good when they go south. On top of that, on top of the Zapata injury, they also have Ilicic, who's dealing with depression. Atalanta, you can't fault them for not seeing that coming. So yeah, there are legit reasons to be concerned there for Atalanta. And you know, Alex, in a way, it reminds me a little bit the Celtics when they were in the bubble. We didn't know it, but the window for the Celtics winning a title with kind of this group may have closed in the bubble, and we didn't see that. At least I certainly did. And I remember Bill Simmons saying it, and I was like, geez, that's actually a pretty astute observation. And he was completely right. Like, that was their chance, was to do it. And I wonder if Atalanta's window to win a trophy, like maybe not even just win the Scudetto, but now we're seeing Inter look really great. We talked that Juve, not only did Juve prime themselves for this season to finish in the top four, but Juve set themselves up to be the co-favorites for Inter last season. Milan continue to look really good. Napoli are no joke. So, you know, it could be that Atalanta's not only this season, but really their window for being the club that they've been and that we thought they could even get to the next step could change. So let's see what happens. We'll keep an eye on them. I'm very curious to see what happens there.
Quickly,
Alex,
David,
before we get go ahead.
I just want to harp on that. Good parallel, by the way, between Atalanta and the Celtics as overall teams. The only difference is, like, I feel like the Celtics could, but they're too stubborn on not wanting to get rid of some certain players that are young, like Jaylen Brown or even Smart, who's a little bit older. With Atalanta, it's more just the teams around them. But you're right, from a collective standpoint, it feels like, oh, they got plenty of time. You know, it's a young, fresh, skilled team. But you don't want to get too comfortable there and say, oh, we have plenty of time. You want to win before other teams start competing. And, you know, honestly, you mentioned the other teams that now could really rival Atalanta and kick them out of the top four. For three out of those four teams, I think it comes down to strikers. So Osimhen obviously coming back to Napoli.
Yeah.
That's big.
Giroud.
Were we spot on? Were we spot on about Giroud when we did the over-unders, right? Not to say we said he was going to smash the total you gave, but we said oh, he's going to have these games where he gets a brace, and he'll probably do it a few times. I know he's done it out of league two now, so it doesn't really count, but that's what Giroux is. And he's also a second half player. He's not played every game 90 minutes. So he really knows how to keep his energy, keep his fitness. And he's a fairly clutch player. He's done this for Chelsea before. What he's doing for Milan right now, he's done for Chelsea before. And then obviously with Juventus getting Vlahovic. So, you know, it's very striker driven as to why Atalanta could be on the outside looking in.
Very well said. Very well said. So before we get to 1,000 names, I wanted to ask you this, and I texted you this yesterday. So the Premier League, for the first time, are going to make more money on their TV rights outside of England than they will in England. And that's really, really massive if you think about it. And the size of the TV contract is just enormous. So, you know, you are kind of, to me, in a lot of ways, you know, you are the international. You know, there's a huge fan base outside of the Premier League here. So I want to ask you, did that surprise you that it's grown so much that now it's at the point that now the Premier League makes more money abroad than they do in the U.S.? Like, to me, the Premier League, as far as leagues, like for appeal here in the U.S., it's almost like the gap between the NFL and the other sports. I mean, the presence of the Premier League here, and that's a huge part of the reasons why that contract abroad is so huge, is massive. So what do you make of that? Were you surprised by that news when I texted you?
Well, yeah, that's quite the statement, right? I mean, already I feel bad for people in the UK that, and it's more of a governmental thing, right? But they can't necessarily, like a Chelsea fan can't necessarily watch a Chelsea game like I can, David. And that makes absolutely no sense to me, you know what I mean? Because I'm not local. So like when we were growing up, right? Say, you know, I'm growing up here in Boston before cable was even a thing. I was guaranteed to get Red Sox games for the most part, especially once cable came about, because you'd at least get your local sport. And it just makes no sense to me that I can get every Chelsea game fairly easily, but people who live maybe 5 minutes away from the stadium can't. But now you're right. It's going a step further, isn't it? It's just more lucrative us watching at this point than the locals and the people that are there. And I guess it doesn't really surprise me. You know, I'll say it here because I know that your listeners, our listeners, are not going to think this is me boasting or bragging. And I don't really like to actually say it to my main demographic because it might come off like that. But David, in Massachusetts or New Hampshire now, if I go out, and this is not me saying like, you know, look at me, I'm getting recognized fairly often. Like fairly often I'm getting recognized. And now I'm in New Hampshire, like in the middle of effing nowhere. And that's not me. That's not because I'm this deal. That's because, wow, the impact of the Premier League is so strong now, and the sport in general, for sure. And look at the other leagues, like the coverage has gotten a lot better. You know, I turn on Paramount Plus and I'm watching random Serie A stuff. It's great. It's great. But the Premier League, you know, I've been stopped by Manchester United and Arsenal fans who are just like, hey, I'm not even a Chelsea fan, but, you know, good work. And I'm thinking, that's really not the power of me. That's the power of the sport. So this is just yet another very, you know, big and kind of bold headline showing the impact of how much it's growing here in the United States. I would say COVID overall makes it a little bit harder for me to just be walking down the street and seeing random people wearing kits. But I feel like if COVID didn't happen, we would see a lot more of that as well. But clearly, people are in their homes watching Premier League. You know, I'm sure, I know this for a fact, even before COVID, you know, bars started to have a lot more, like during the afternoon, like it almost certainly there'd be on a random Premier League game. I mean, look at over here, NBC Sports, the channel recently kind of disappeared, but now it's USA, which is a network that is really not a sports network, or was it? You know, might have like random wrestling on, and now it's having all of these, like you could turn on USA and you could see West Ham, Southampton. Like that is big. You know, that's like TNT having on a random basketball game or TBS having on a baseball game in the afternoon. So I'm not complaining, certainly. I wish it was a little bit more balanced, to be honest, for the people who live there. But yeah, I would say that's a big measure of the growth.
Yeah, no, for sure. And, you know, to piggyback and to tie it into Serie A, like, look, the Premier League's been working at this in the U.S. for like over a decade, you know, and I think, you know, people, you could watch it so easily on network TV. Like now I know it's in a bunch of different apps and all, but it was so easy to watch. I think the times of day that it was on was just perfect. You know, a lot of people in the U.S. on weekends, of course, are watching the NFL, and you could watch in the morning the Premier League games. Yeah. And look, you know, I got to give credit. You mentioned Paramount. I thought it was great that, you know, they went on location. They produced the derby themselves as opposed to just getting the feed. I have to say, seeing my friend Marco Messina next to Bobo Vieri at San Siro is just really, really awesome. Like, what a journey that was. So look, you know, they're trying in a way to kind of do it in the same way. It's just the Premier League really invested time. And I think Paramount, I think they're doing a great job, but the Premier League is just much better at marketing their product. Serie A goes out of the way to do the opposite, making it really, really hard. So, you know, a lot of people ask me, hey, you know, will Serie A ever catch up to the Premier League? Now, I think with this deal, I really don't. And, you know, one of the reasons, look, there's a ton of reasons why I love doing the show with Alex, but one of the reasons why we have him on is also to kind of try to widen the net, the appeal. Like, we have a ton of people that started listening to the pod for transfer rumors of a Serie A player going to the Premier League. And I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. Let me start watching the games. And then you watch Serie A the past few years, you're going to be incredibly entertained. So I think, though, like I mentioned, to me, this deal that the Premier League has here in the U.S. and a lot of markets abroad, it's really going to become like the difference between the TV ratings between the NFL and the NBA, which are just like, I think a random Thursday night game of the NFL with two crap teams is going to get like way better ratings than even a conference finals in the NBA. And the Premier League has done just the type of work that, unfortunately, I don't think Serie A as a league is ever going to do. But let's get 2,000 names. There really are some great games this weekend. Let's see what he has in store for us. He was extra peppy this week, so I might have to do a little editing on the fly. So great game. Inter, after that derby that they lost, and the Inter fans are very upset over this game, traveling to Napoli to face Osimhen and their former manager Spalletti. 1,000 names has Napoli winning 2-0. Osimhen brace. He says Ospina is going to save a penalty on Lukaku's boy Lautaro. He says Perisic is going to get a red card. And he says Spalletti is going to get revenge on the fact he was sacked and is going to fly at the top of the standings in Marotta's face. And that De Laurentiis is going to start dreaming about the Scudetto. And he says Limone and Zaghi is without an attack at Inter. In Italian, Napoli-Inter 2-0, Osimhen doppietta, Ospina para rigore Lautaro. Espulso Perisic, Luciano si vendica dell'esonero e vola in testa alla faccia di Marotta. De Laurentiis sogna lo scudetto, Limone senza attacco. We didn't talk about Inter at the top. We had covered them not that long ago. I'm very curious to see how they react from that derby. I was watching the game with my friends at the Boston Milan fan club. I didn't tell them there, but I thought in the first half, Inter was just like a whole other class compared to Milan. And I got to be honest, I felt that when they played in the first derby as well. But then they end up losing. And there is maybe a little bit of Pazza Inter coming back with this. So I'm still pretty confident that Inter are going to win the Scudetto. I think the only team that can stop Inter is Inter themselves. But we did see on Sunday that it's not out of the question. And there's been a lot of question marks on Handanovic. And on Sunday last week, those chickens came home to roost. But Napoli, big win against Venezia last weekend. But I'm going to, you know, I'm confident on Inter. I don't think they win, but I think it's 1-1. I'll give Osimhen a goal, and I'll give Lautaro a goal, and he certainly needs one in Serie A. Next up, Roma traveling to Sassuolo. 1,000 names has Roma winning 3-0, goal by Smalling, Cristante, Vertu. He says Mourinho is going to cancel the loss in the Coppa Italia, and he says Carnevali is deep down a Juve fan. I don't know, 1,000 names, very upset with Sassuolo here. Pronostic in Italian, Sassuolo-Roma 0-3, Smalling, Cristante, Vertu. Mourinho cancella la sconfitta in Coppa, and he says Carnevali is un gobbo, you can figure out the rest. Roma, they've been... that Zaniolo experience that we had last weekend was really something. Those 5 minutes of you could have summed up everything about Zaniolo in those 5 minutes at the end of that game. I feel like you could watch every minute Zaniolo's played in his career, or you could just watch that and you'd have almost the same and correct impression of what he's all about. I digress. Sassuolo did lose 4-0 to Sampdoria last weekend. I'm going to go Roma 1-0, and I'll give another goal to Oliveira, who's been a lot of fun to watch. Other huge game, man. I really miss, there's just too many games now. We just jump from Coppa Italia to this, that I really miss the build-up. So we have Milan-Juve coming up on Sunday. Fausen has Kessié scoring 2 goals, and he says Pioli is going to move forward with the help of penalties. No, actually, this is Milan-Sampdoria, not Juve. I apologize. You see, that's how much the schedule has messed me up in 1002. So I take it back. Milan-Sampdoria, 2-0. Kessié, 2 goals. Pioli moves forward with the penalties. Gianpaolo is going to give Milan some help after struggling with them as a manager. Brahim is the worst on the pitch. And that Junior Messias is ready to go back to being a delivery driver. In Italian, it's Milan-Sampdoria, not Milan-Juve. Kessié, 2 goals, 2-0. Pioli avanti coi rigorini. Gianpaolo si scansa contro il suo passato. Brahim peggiore in campo. Junior Messias torna a fare il fattorino. Fidatevi. So Giovinco's now on Sampdoria. He signed there. They did score 4 against Sassuolo. Milan coming off the derby. But you know what? I'm going to ride Milan. I'm going to go Milan 2-1. I'll give Leao and Kessié a goal. I'll agree with Fausen. And then I'll give Quagliarella a goal for Sampdoria. So as always, thank you, Thousand Names, for your picks. It's always great to have you as the show. So, before we get to our patrons, let's introduce our first guest, Daniele Mazzanti, who's our regular Milan fan. He's one of the hosts of the Vox to Box pod, which I absolutely adore. We owed you kind of a Milan take on what happened with the Spezia match. Sorry, I didn't get to it. The Vlahovic deal kind of got in the way, but I think you're going to get a really, really fun dose of Milan here.
Oh, I'm very excited to welcome our next guest. We were chatting right before I hit record, and our dear friend Daniele Mazzanti mentioned how this is the perfect week to talk about Milan. And indeed it is, a lot going on. For those of you not familiar with Daniele's work, shame on you. All kidding aside, he is one of the hosts of the outstanding Vox to Box podcast in Italy, my favorite culture show, which I get to do an appearance once a year, which I really enjoy. It's really, really great content. Daniele has been kind of our Milan guy for a while. He's been with us through the peaks and valleys. There's been some very tough moments, but also I think this week is maybe as good as it's been since we've had you on. So Daniele, always a real pleasure to chat with you. Bentornato to Calcioland.
Grazie mille. It's always a pleasure. It's always an honor to be your guest and also to be your Milan guy. It's a huge honor for me to be your Milan guy. So thank you.
We're very lucky to have you. So as we were chatting before we recording, Inter fans are in full meltdown mode after the derby. But I want to ask you this, because I was watching actually the game with the local Milan club here in Boston. And I got to say, I thought the first half, I thought Inter looked really, really good. It almost looked like, you know, there was like a massive gap between the two teams. So walk me through your feelings as you were going into halftime. How did you feel about the first part of the game?
Well, I have to say one thing. Like I used to do few bets in my life. Like I love to bet on football games live. So during the game. And I'm a pretty optimistic guy, so usually I try to bet on AC Milan when AC Milan is down. I bet on AC Milan when AC Milan were down like 2-0 against 0-2 against Verona, for example, this season. But this time at the end of the first half in the derby, I never ever thought about opening my bet up because I was pretty sure that AC Milan will lose that game because Inter was so superior in the first half, and the first half was basically Inter against AC Magnan, not AC Milan, and I was very surprised when we scored the first Giroud goal, and basically I didn't expect the second, because it's very true that in the second half Inter did basically nothing, but they were in control, and we won the game. So basically it's perfect. That's perfection for us.
Right, I'm sure. So yeah, the second half things changed a ton. So obviously, I think the two heroes are Magnan and Giroud, and we'll get to Magnan a little bit later. So I got to ask you this, other than those two players, who stood out to you in the second half? Who do you think is mainly responsible for Milan's remarkable turnaround?
I'd say, first, the midfielders. I think both Tonali and Bennacer did a super game. They had super performances against Inter, and it was not easy because they played against one of the best midfield in Italy for sure, and they were great. I heard a lot of praise about Tonali, and he deserves everything. But Bennacer was super good. Was the one that ruled the midfield, ruled the game, and decided the pace of the whole AC Milan squad. And in the second half, he was amazing. So I think, other than Magnan and Giroud, of course, I'm going with Bennacer and Tonali because they were super good, I'd say. Also, I have to praise Romagnoli for one thing. Romagnoli didn't play like the best game ever. We know that right now he is a bit struggling, I'd say.
Yeah.
And but in the second half, when Alexis Sanchez came in, he decided to do full pressing on him, following also in the midfielder in the midfield, and the first score from AC Milan started thanks to the pressing by Alessio Romagnoli on Alexis Sanchez, and then Alexis Sanchez lost the ball, and then Giroud scored in that play, in that action. So I want to praise Alessio Romagnoli for this, but of course it was not an easy game for him. I was impressed by Pierre Kalulu, but he made that mistake on the corner kick where Inter scored, basically. But if you watched the game, you saw a very good central back, and we never thought about it. Like we bought him for free, basically, and he's very good. I think that we used to praise other young footballers, young defenders around the Europe, like someone who is doing great in Bundesliga or in Liga, etc. And we're talking about a guy who was born in 2000. So he's 21, 22 years old, and he's very good, and he's good as a fullback or center back. So I'm really impressed by the improvement shown by Kalulu.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so that's perfect segue for the next question, because I almost think like the fact that Kalulu played well and Gabbia to a lesser extent kind of changed a little bit Milan's plans in the January window. I mean, you have both starting center backs who had surgery here before the window even opened. So let me ask you this. You look at this win, which changes the trajectory of Milan's season. So in a way, what's a bigger regret for you? The terrible ending to the Spezia game or the club's inactivity in the January window? If, say, the Scudetto race ends up being just a couple of points, when you look back, are one of these two things going to be like, geez, you know, I really wish one of these two didn't happen?
So I'd like to answer with both, but if I have to pick one, I'd say the Spezia game, because it's very true that not buying any central back from the market in January is a sort of statement, like from the owners, like we are good. We are not aiming to win the title, the Scudetto. For us, is good to come back to the Champions League, and it's fine. We are fine with that. But on the other side, the Spezia game was terrible for us, not only for the 3 points that we lost, but for the enthusiasm, because AC Milan is a very young team who is playing on like the strength of this team is that is a young, fresh, happy, enthusiastic team, and that thing was a sort of like a terrible thing that created a bad environment around the team, and I think Pioli was very, very good in keeping keeping a good environment in the team, in the squad. Around, if you talk with any AC Milan supporter, we after the game against Spezia, we were lost.
Yeah,
like I lose everything. I lost every single joy on thinking about football, and that was a pity because, for example, if you watch the game between AC Milan and Juventus, you saw that Milan was a different team from a normal game of this season and the last season, because we used to play. Even with all the injuries or the players that are out, et cetera, we used to play with a lot of garra, a lot of grind. Like we used to do a super high pressing. We run a lot, et cetera. All these aspects against Juventus were lost because we had not that an enthusiastic approach to the football, and I think this win in the derby is perfect because it's the perfect time to have a win like this, because we need to come back to that enthusiastic approach of football that this team shown in the last two seasons.
I couldn't agree more with you on Pioli. I think the way he spoke and what he did after the Spezia match, which was, you know, keep the focus on what you can control, saying, you know what, we should have scored more goals. It should have never come to that. I thought it was brilliant, because you see a lot of other managers would have just blamed the referee, give their players an excuse to be upset and all. And I thought he handled that perfectly. So I couldn't agree more with you there. So I think I've asked you this question before, but I always like to ask you as time passes, as the season evolves. So obviously, Maignan had a great game. We're recording this on the day that Donnarumma, you know, gave the interview to Gazzetta dello Sport on his departure from Milan. Maybe not the best timing. And Maignan obviously was sensational in the derby. I think it's very safe to say Milan has not missed Donnarumma one bit. So there's that. And then Tonali, who I, you know, the thing that stands out to me about Tonali is he's been great every season, but the bigger the game, usually the better the performance for him. I'm so impressed with him as a player. So between the two, and I think I've asked you this before, as of today, which of the two has surprised you more this season?
I think that back in the days when you asked me first this question, I said, I replied with Tonali. And I keep Tonali because I want to be honest. I didn't know Maignan before because I don't watch Ligue 1. I watch French team in European Cups, etc. But I'm not used to be a fan of Ligue 1. So I didn't know what kind of goalkeeper Maignan was. And since the first appearance with the AC Milan, I understood that we both not only are a very, very good goalkeeper, but also a man who is a leader, because he's a leader and he's improving the whole defense, because every single defender is very, very he knows that he has a goalkeeper who is very good with his ability with passing the ball, etc. So it's like giving the ball in a bank. Giving to Maignan is like putting the ball in the bank, because you know you're good with pass the ball to Maignan, and this is a huge difference between him and Donnarumma. I'd say even if Donnarumma was improving his skills in passing the ball, etc. In order to answer your question, I'd say Tonali, because if I think about Tonali last year, I never ever was able to even think about him as a pillar of our team. And I heard a very interesting thing in the Zone shows after the games. I think was Marco Parolo, who was talking about the improvements from Tonali, and he said, I think one thing that is different between this Tonali and the last Tonali, of course, is experience, but also the fact that right now he is a football player of AC Milan. Last season, he was a player who was on loan to AC Milan. And this is different because the approach, like he's feeling that he is an AC Milan player, and he doesn't need to show anything more, because he's already a player of AC Milan, so he can play well without any second think about do they want to buy me in a permanent way or not,
etc.
This trouble. So I think that Renato Tonali is probably one of the best midfielder in Italy, and I'm very happy for him, even because he is a true Milan fan. He is one of us. So these things for us tifosi are very, very important.
For
so
sure.
I'd say Tonali, yes.
Yeah, no.
We all think that he's going to be our next captain.
Oh yeah.
And it's not easy, because every single captain we had in the last seasons left us basically, or or is Romagnoli, poor guy.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that band is not, that arm band is not lucky in the last seasons. But yes, we think that he's going to be our next captain.
Yeah, no, I can totally see that. So you mentioned Bennacer, which is a good shout. So I kind of want to end on this because, you know, a lot was made of the Africa Cup right before the season. Maybe I overrated the impact of it. Obviously, Milan had multiple starters, same with Napoli. But then you look at the standings and the Scudetto race is probably closer now than it was when the Africa Cup started. I think having the international break certainly helped. So let me ask you this. Would you say it's fair to say the Africa Cup didn't have much impact on Milan? Or would you say, hey, had Kessie and Bennacer not gone, we might even be in a better position in the standings. So how much do you think this ultimately changed for Milan?
So I'd say that I agree with you. The African Cup didn't have this huge impact on AC Milan. If you think about the games we played in January, we lost against Spezia, but with Bennacer or Kessie, it's hard to say that would be different. Like that over there, the problem was that we didn't score the goal and the referee did that terrible mistake. Other than that, we lost against Napoli, but against Napoli, it was in December, I think, not in January. I do not remember, but I think that, yeah, African Cup didn't have this huge impact. Probably Napoli was more affected by this competition, also because they had, of course, Kalidou Koulibaly and Zambanghissa and Osimhen was out with the whole province, etc. But so basically, probably that was more impactful for them than for us. We, of course, we struggled without Bennacer and Kessie, but as we were saying before, we have Tonali, and so without Tonali, that would have been a huge problem. But with Tonali, not so much, I'd say.
Okay, let's close on this. A couple of rapid fire questions. I'm going to put you on the spot. I always like to pick your brain. So tell me, how confident should Inter fans, in your opinion, be that they're going to win the Scudetto and get the second Stella? Or do you think realistically Inter fans should be very concerned right now?
Tough question, but I say they are the favorite for, like, I think that Inter is too strong for the other. The only thing that could change this race if some bad injuries, of course, I not
yeah.
wish.
And they've been lucky with that for sure. I'm kind of with you. I feel like only Inter can stop Inter this season.
Yes.
And we had a little Pazza Inter on the derby, so it's not out of the question. Other question, do you think Juve is going to break into the top four? You know, I'm not even going to say knocking out which team. Do you think Juve finishes top four?
Yes. Yes, I think so. And I remember that you asked me this, like, almost the same question some months ago. And I said, like, I don't think Juventus could be in the top four because they were very bad, of course, back in the days. And I think that, of course, they have some big problems also right now, but of course if you spend 80 millions in a January market and you bought the probably the second best young forward you can get right now, and also Zakaria in the midfield, I think they will finish in the top four, also because Atalanta right now
they're a little bit in trouble. Yeah. And yeah. Zapata is a big problem for them, for sure.
Every single year, Atalanta have a sort of month of pause where they lose, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But right now, this is different because losing Zapata for four months, et cetera, it's a big trouble for
them. Sure. Last one, real fast. A, how jealous are you that Vlahovic is at Juve? And B, this is a good question that one of my patrons asked, and I want to get your opinion. Do you think Vlahovic is more likely to win Capocannoniere now that he's at Juve playing for Allegri, or would he have had a better chance of winning it had he stayed at Fiorentina playing in Italiano's system? Which do you think would have been more likely? I think it's a great question.
Yes. I'd say, starting from the A question, of course, I'm devastated by this because I love Vlahovic and I didn't want him to be a Juventus player, etc. So, yes, as we said in Italy, sto rosicando because I wanted him so much in AC Milan, but it was just a dream. For the second one, well, I have Vlahovic basically in every fantasy team I have. So Fantacalcio for us.
Yeah.
And I'd say probably he if he remained in Fiorentina, probably he had the best chance to be capocannoniere because the team was playing for him, and probably the offensive side of the of Fiorentina is better than the Juventus one, and it's a sort of absurd because Juventus have Morata and Dybala and right now Vlahovic, but the tactics from the trainers from Allegri and Italiano are very different. So probably the game, the Italiano's game is more offensive than the one from Allegri. So for my fantasy team, I think that would have been better to have him in Firenze.
Yeah, and now you have to root for a Juve striker on top of that. So
It's a very bad situation. Yes, it's a very bad situation. But they are two different sports. I think always like that. Like fantasy football is one thing and football is another one. And football, of course, is more important.
There you go. Well, Daniele, as always, fantastic job. Listen, guys, if you speak Italian or are learning Italian and have not checked out Vox to Box, absolutely go. We've had Daniele many times. Really, really great stuff. It's awesome. If you're one of our patrons, Vox to Box is also on Patreon. I'll tell you, they have a ton of amazing content. They have so many different things. I love it. I feel like I'm back in Italy listening to them. So, Daniele, thank you so much. Great job as always. And I look forward to chatting culture with you later this season.
Thank you so much, David. It's always an honor and it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, always great to hear from Daniele Mazzanti. Before we get to our next guest, which I'm very excited to have on to make his debut on Calcioland, we're going to get to our patrons. So if you enjoyed the show, please consider becoming a patron or leaving us a review on iTunes. We've gotten some really good ones recently. Now on Spotify, you can leave a 5-star rating. Those things really help our podcast become more visible. So if you could do that, we appreciate it. If you enjoyed, especially at the end, the segment on Zamparini, if you want to tweet about it, I'd really appreciate it. I put a lot of work in that segment. So, I appreciate if we can get it to a lot of people. I think that segment on Zamparini, if I had to pick one to show what Calcioland's all about, that would be one of those that I would pick. Okay, guys, before we get to the weekend, we have one more guest. We teased it a few times on the show, but it really is a great segment on Zamparini. I think if you've been listening to the pod for a while, you know that one of my biases is when everyone's zigging, I like to zag. I found, a lot of the coverage of Zamparini's death was so focused on the sackings that's almost the only thing you heard. So not only do I like to
to zig when other people are zagging. The other thing is I try to be really conscious of people who are really known for one thing. Is that really fair? And I think Zamparini was such an incredible figure that we really wanted to pay tribute and try to give you a better sense of what he was all about. You know, one of the reasons that I love Calcio are these colorful presidents, like huge personalities and whatnot. And I feel like that's slowly but surely going away. We have a lot of foreign owners. We have investment funds buying clubs in Italy, but Zamparini was really one of a kind. So I really want to thank Benny Giardina. I've been circling him on the pod for a while for really doing an outstanding job. I put a lot of work in this segment. So if you enjoyed it, please share it with friends. Please leave us a review. I would really appreciate it. But I think it came out really well, and I hope you enjoy it.
So there really is no better person to have this discussion that I've wanted to have on Zamparini than Benny Giardina. I've been following him for a long time. He's one of my favorite calcio journalists in Italy. And then I discovered he does a ton more than calcio right now. He's actually covering the Olympics in Italy. But on top of, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to have him on is he also wrote a fantastic article on Zamparini, which I'll share the link. And that's kind of the inspiration for the show. So, Benny, before we get started, as I welcome you since your first time here, please give our listeners a little bit of a background on you and kind of how you started covering Palermo and specifically Zamparini.
Hi, David, and thanks so much for your intro, because it's true, I didn't start with the Palermo football or soccer team. I have to say, I didn't even want to start with football in my career, but living in Palermo and living in a city where the only elite team in professional sports was the football team, because right now it's not really that elite. Well, you have to deal with that and you have to follow football. But I started with basketball. I used to cover also sometimes water polo, tennis, those kind of sports. You know, I was trying to follow basketball, and I had also covered some NBA matches for some Italian website. But you know, it's not the same to follow it live. And then I started following live basketball in Sicily, other sports. Then I understood that in Sicily, but I think in Italy is not a problem of Palermo. You have to deal with football if you want to make a career out of journalism, out of sports journalism, obviously. And well, then it started in 2012. My history with Palermo as a journalist, as an advertised journalist at first, and then in 2016 I started covering Palermo Football Club for Il Giornale di Sicilia, which is the main newspaper in Palermo. And then from then on I started having a good relationship with the president Zamparini. But then, you know, you may never say if it was a good relationship with him, because his behavior, his character was exactly the same you saw in the interviews, when he was in the assemblies of the Italian Lega Calcio. Well, that was the real Zamparini. That's why I will define him as an authentic president, an authentic man, probably not a sincere man or a man who always said the truth. But you know, I don't think there is a president who says the truth in Italian football. Zamparini was just like the others from this point of view. But his behavior was the same at the phone, in front of the camera, so when he was alone. Just an authentic, and in some way also a genuine man, a genuine president. And when he had to say that he didn't like you, or he want to say some bad words to you, and he told me a lot of bad words. I have to say, he didn't make no problems to do that.
For sure. No, I love your article because you use the word genuino to describe him. And I think that's a really great word to do. So listen, some of our listeners are more casual fans and got into, calcio recently for whatever reasons. So give our listeners who might not be that familiar with Palermo kind of a sense of the size of the club, what the club was like before Zamparini took over, and how far he took them, because I think a lot of people might not realize the situation Palermo was in even before he took over.
I think I can easily say that Zamparini put Palermo on the map. In Italy, Europe, before Zamparini, there was nothing. There was really nothing, because Palermo reached this latest great results in 1979, and it was a Serie B team who reached the Coppa Italia final, lost against Juventus. But after that, Palermo didn't do anything. Palermo got into bankruptcy in 1986, and the city of Palermo stayed 1 year without football, then restarted from the fourth division and struggled a lot to gain Serie B. And in Serie B, we never saw a competitor for a promotion in Serie A. We always saw a Palermo struggling for salvation. Just 1 year, Palermo arrived seventh with a team built up, made from the youngster, from the so-called Primavera team. A lot of players born in Palermo, born in Sicily. And they made an half miracle, because at the end of the first round of the season, Palermo was, if not first, at least in one of the first four positions. At the time in Serie B, the first four clubs were promoted to Serie A. And Palermo was living a real dream at the time, because nobody could even think about a Palermo team in Serie A. And we were talking about 1995-1996, so not so much time ago. And when Zamparini came in Palermo wasn't even thinking about playing Serie A. You can imagine what it means for a team who has been brought in 2002 by Zamparini, playing in Europe in 2005. 3 years. Yeah. 3 years, it's from incredible. Nothing to Europe. It's been too fast, because in Palermo it seems like it was a duty to go in Europe to go in UEFA Cup or in Champions League. Palermo never played Champions League, but it seemed like Palermo had to play Champions League for the fans, for the people of Palermo. It seemed normal because, well, it was too fast, but the reality is that Palermo wasn't even in the map of Italian football before Zamparini. Zamparini put Palermo on the map. Then Zamparini put also Palermo out of the map, because the things that happened in his last 4 or 5 years of ownership, well, I think have been that bad that a lot of people right now doesn't think that Zamparini has been one of the greatest presidents in Palermo. But the reality is that without Zamparini, Palermo could have never reached that kind of results.
Well, you know, it's kind of like the Dark Knight. You stick around long enough, you go from being the hero to the villain, especially in Italian football. And you know what stands out to me, Benny, as you were talking, is this wasn't even the first time Zamparini did this. You know, I grew up in Padova and I saw what he did with Venezia, and he didn't bring them quite to Palermo's apex, which we'll get to in a second. But what he did at Palermo was not the first time that he did something quite similar. And I love what you said, that it was almost too fast. So let me ask you this. If you have to pick like a game or a moment that you feel was like the apex of Zamparini's Palermo, which moment would it be and why?
Serie A 2004-2005, Palermo Juventus 1-0. Goal made by Franco Brienza. It was the the moment where everyone in Palermo realized that Zamparini was going to make something great. Because, okay, the promotion in Serie A was a little bit announced by Zamparini, because we all know Zamparini came in Palermo to bring Palermo to Serie A. That was at least the main results he had to reach. But beating Juventus, fighting for a place in Champions League, playing in Europe, that was something that nobody could have ever expected, because we all knew who Zamparini was and what Zamparini did in Venezia. We knew that Zamparini in Venezia had great ambitions, but Venezia only once gets salvation in Serie A. He always came in Serie A and then came back in Serie B. That was Venezia, and everybody in Palermo thought that Palermo was going to be, if not the same, at least a team that could just fight for salvation in Serie A. And at the first year, we understood it was not the case, because Palermo was fighting against Juventus, against Milan. Milan in Palermo Palermo-Milan ended 0-0 at the first year. Palermo beat Juventus at the Barbera at the first year. Palermo beat Inter at the Barbera at the second year. It's been a lot of incredible results against those giants club in Italy. And I mean, Palermo didn't even imagine to play against those teams. For example, I remember when Juventus won his last European Super Cup. It was 1996, if I don't go wrong. At the time, the UEFA Super Cup was played in two legs. The first one at home of the UEFA Cup Winners' Cup team, and the other at home of the UEFA Champions League winner. Well, Juventus won against Paris Saint-Germain in Paris 6-1 maybe, or 5-1, something like this. I mean, the return game was already written, there wasn't even need to play the game, and Juventus knew that at the Delle Alpi Stadium couldn't reach a lot of people, you know, when Juventus played, and in Delle Alpi didn't have a lot of audience at the stadium, just for the big games. So when you play again against PSG and you won the first game 5-1 or 6-1, you already know that not many people are coming to the stadium. So Juventus decided to play in Palermo. This is something that
incredible.
Today,
yeah, it's incredible.
Today you can think about it. If you think about another teams that come to play in Palermo, you have to be scared because of the fans. At the time, there was no problem because Palermo had I don't want to say that Palermo had no history, but at that time, in 96, 97, Palermo football was something like, wasn't on the map. Exactly as I said before, Zamparini put Palermo on the map. And that's something that everyone in Palermo should remind right now, because Palermo right now, it's out of the map. And I'm afraid it will stay out of the map for a lot of years, because the actual team is not good enough to reach Serie B, struggling in Serie C. And I don't know if it's going to be lucky enough to win the playoffs. But, you know, even if it reaches Serie B, what happens then? That's something you didn't have to think about with Zamparini, because the worst season Palermo has had with Zamparini are the best season that could have been made with the other presidents in every year of Palermo Football Club lives. From 1979 to 2002, Palermo has never been fifth or sixth in Serie B.
Incredible.
Palermo in the worst season with Zamparini arrived fifth in Serie B. Or if we want to consider the last season of the US Città di Palermo with the when they deducted 20 points, well, Palermo ended in the middle of the chart in Serie B, and that's something that before Zamparini could have been considered a good result, and it was the worst result ever with Zamparini.
Very well said. Yeah, I think at the Delle Alpi, they were getting much better attendance when they had a big concert than when Juve was playing. But that's a really great detail that Juve played there. I love it. So speaking of Juve, you know, I really liked what Dybala posted on Instagram after Zamparini passed. I thought he wrote beautifully. But Dybala is just one of many very talented players that have come to Italy because of Zamparini and Palermo. What I loved about your article that you wrote is I didn't know this, that Zamparini didn't particularly like going to the actual games, but he loved going to the Ritiro, the Amichevoli in the summer, like kind of a little bit of a talent scout. So aside from Dybala, tell us a little bit about some of the other extremely talented and famous players that arrived in Italy thanks to Zamparini.
The first one that came to my mind is absolutely Andrea Barzagli, because I'm pretty sure a lot of people don't remind him in Palermo. But Barzagli, I don't want to say that he started in Palermo, he started in Chievo, but Palermo was the first team that really believed in Barzagli as a great
player. And he
player.
Was on Palermo when Italy won the World Cup in 2006, right? Exactly. If I remember correctly, yeah.
Exactly. Palermo had four player in the Italy 2006 World Cup winner, and they were Barzagli, Zaccardo, Grosso and Barone. Plus, Luca Toni was in Palermo when he was first called up from the national team, so he was no more a Palermo player in 2006, but he came to the national team as a Palermo player. And after the World Cup, Amelia, the second goalkeeper, played in Palermo too. So that Palermo had a lot of players in Italian national team when they won the World Cup and when they continued playing at highest level in Europe and all around the world. Just after the Lippi period, Palermo had less and less players in the Azzurri team, but you know, in 2004-2006 period, Palermo was probably one of the most represented team in Italian national team. There was a game played in the United States two games exactly, against Ecuador and against the United States team, where Palermo had something like eight players, and it's something you can't even try to think about it now. Eight players from Palermo to the national team. There were also Brienza, Guardalben, those kind of players who nobody could have imagined them in national team. Brienza was playing in Serie C with Palermo before Zamparini. Zamparini was the one who believed in him because Guidolin didn't want him on the team, and Zamparini decided that he was going to stay in the team. Brienza then became a national team player, and he had an absolutely fantastic career in Serie A and Serie B, thanks to Palermo, thanks to Zamparini.
Awesome. Love it. Great
but
stuff.
I mean, Brienza is probably the 100th best player passed from Zamparini, taken from Zamparini, because Barzagli, Zaccardo, Grosso were those kind of players. Ilicic, who is one of the main stars of the fantastic Atalanta right now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's been found from Zamparini. We still don't know.
He found him too. Man, I totally forgot that. You're right. That's right. Yeah, you took me down memory lane. I wouldn't have guessed that there were four guys from Palermo on that Italy team. Unbelievable. So again, I'm going to piggyback to that article that you wrote, which was really great. I love the story that during the Ritiro in Friuli, where he's from, he invited all the media and he made food, and he's like, I picked these mushrooms myself, and everyone was worried they would get poisoned, and he's like, no, I ate them the day before. Then I read that he was fascinated with aliens. I love the story of when the circles showed up on the pitch, and then you shared with me a story before we started recording. But in the article, I love the story that you put that basically, you know, the whole media knew that Walter Zenga was going to be Palermo's next coach because he didn't hang up the phone or something correctly, and he was just leaking it. So I love it. So give our listeners a little bit the sense of what Zamparini was like as a person beyond what he did with Palermo, putting him on the map, as you put, and discovering so many great players.
You know, you couldn't even imagine when Zampanini was calm or was angry, because I remember a press conference he made. It was a bit of a surprise because, you know, when Zampanini came in Palermo, we, as a journalist, we have all kind of sources who informed us, okay, Zampanini's here. And when Zampanini came, at least five or six journalists were always there looking for him or talking with him. And one of those days, he decided to organize a press conference with no further advice. And he seemed calm. He was talking calmly. He was explaining why he was there, because there were problems with the Dybala agent at the time. And then all of a sudden, he started shouting. He was really angry. We didn't see that coming. That was Zamparini behavior with us. And I think it was Zamparini behavior with everyone. But one of the sweetest things I will always remember of him coming in Palermo was, you know, Palermo is such an old town. It still has market in the old way, so not the mall as you could understand as an American, but an open air market all around the city. There are at least three big markets like this in Palermo: Ballarò, La Bucceria, and El Capo. I think if you have some listener with parents coming from Sicily, will surely understand of what I'm talking about. One of those days, he decided to go in one of those markets. And it's been incredible, because at the time, Zamparini was a sort of god in Palermo, because he put Palermo on the map. He brought Palermo to Serie A. You can't imagine a person like this walking in a popular borough like those markets. He did it. He did it without any kind of problem. And everybody cheered at him because he was loved at the time. And that's something I will always remember, because that was, in my opinion, the real side, the good side of Zamparini. When he was with other people who tried to impress him positively, he needed that kind of, I don't know how to say, that kind of feedback from the people. When people started to contest him, to not to like him anymore, he felt bad and he decided to come in Palermo less and less. But at the time, I think we saw the real good face of Zamparini. And he showed him to the people of Palermo, not to the fans, not to the journalists, but to the workers, to the people who worked at the market in Palermo, to the people who woke up at 4 in the morning or 5 in the morning to start working at the market. That was something you don't expect from an owner of a football team.
Fantastic, Benny. And I've been doing this pod many years. I've had a lot of awesome guests, but this is one of the segments I'm most proud of, because I really am very happy with what you did here. I feel very good that we kind of gave a bigger picture of a figure that I think is, again, like I said, my romanticism of Italian football. Like when I see someone like Zamparini leaving us, that's like a piece of the reasons why I love calcio so much. And I think you did an outstanding job doing this. So Benny, thank you so much. I know you're extremely busy. You're covering the Olympics. You're always up to something. Your work is really, really high quality. So all of you that speak Italian or are learning Italian, definitely check out Benny's work. I'm going to tweet out the article on Zamparini that he wrote, but there's just one of many. So thank you so much for doing this, my friend. I look forward to having you again on the podcast soon. You did a fantastic job today. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, David.